This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today, catching up with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon, as we like to do as often as we can. President Simon, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Russ. It's fun to have this sort of in the downtime at Michigan State, as most people see it. But, you know, we have over 20,000 students, and lots of people are on campus for different purposes than the regular semesters.
President Simon, your thoughts on the final passage of the state's higher education budget for fiscal year 2015, which does provide a 5.9% increase for Michigan's 15 public universities.
Well, I think this reflects the work that business leaders from Michigan and others have done to have an evidence-based approach to why we need to invest in public higher education in Michigan. You go around the country, you go around the state, people say talent, talent, talent. We have to compete with the world's best. And Michigan, in the period of time up until, you know, for the last 10 years from 2000 and FY04 to FY14, higher education was a minus 16% in appropriation, not counting inflation, while our competitor states in the Big Ten were as high as a 50% increase for our new partners in Maryland and Rutgers to places like Nebraska and Indiana that were in the plus 25% range. So this is coming out of a period of just significant decline, and business leaders has really argued we need to sort of reverse that trend, that Michigan needs to be a top 10 state. But it comes with a portion of this allocation based on performance funding that means that on a set of variables that I think have been consistent over the last 3 years, which I think is really good to make sure that performance matters. It's not just having more money. And then hopefully this will be part of a continuing trend to bring us back to a top 10 state.
And President Simon, you mentioned talent a moment ago, and last time we spoke about the T-shaped professionals and some of the different skills that employers are looking for in our graduates. How do we promote our talent now inside and out of the state? Do we do it differently?
Well, I think that part of it is sort of staying with the premise that's always been sort of in the DNA of Michigan State for the beginning, when you look at that T-shirt that said good enough for the proudest, open to the poorest, that we would be able to educate individuals who brought their passion to Michigan State and their talent, who could compete with anyone in the world. Those opportunities were here. And I think the workforce in Michigan is turning around. The Chamber of Commerce, business leaders from Michigan are really promoting internships, because what happens when people have internships, they, in fact, get to have an affiliation, a soft spot for that company, and that helps to retain talent. I think the public opinion polls would show that the people of Michigan believe that Michigan has turned a corner. Detroit is really important in that, because young people are gravitating to urban settings and dynamic urban settings, large urban settings. And the resurgence of Detroit can only help in that retention of talent. So I think there's just a lot of factors that are coming together. We just need to we can't be complacent. We just need to continue to work harder and harder, again, to make sure that we are preparing students that anybody in the world wants. They just want to stay here.
I'm talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon on MSU Today. And President Simon, you recently attended the Mackinac Policy Conference, which you do each year. Are there one or two specific takeaways that are resonating with you this year?
Talent. I mean, you go through the entire conference, whether it's STEM education, sort of thinking about big data and the skills it will take that are very, very different to deal with this deluge of bits and bytes and terabytes that are coming at us, and how to make use of those. Because just having data doesn't mean that it's useful and that you get value out of it. And that's going to take a different kind of approach that really is about blending the creativity, the design, the seeing patterns that you often attribute to the liberal arts, visual arts, with this quantitative understanding of the workings of these processes, so that you know that what comes out is really good, because anything can come out of an algorithm. And so how do we not only deal with the gap in people in certain job sets now, but how do we also look to the future to educate and think about opportunities for things that have not yet been created? So in that sense, it wasn't much different than the IBM discussions on T-shaped conferences. We were in Washington recently with BLM and meeting with a whole set of both higher education and I would call business organizations like the Business Roundtable. All of them are saying about the same thing, that we have to continue to up our game.
Also at the conference on Mackinac, President Simon, the University Research Corridor released its report on the blue economy and how the university's partner to protect Michigan's precious water resources through hundreds of millions of dollars in research and service. What's important for Michiganders to remember about that report?
Well, it really was remarkable from my perspective. I think the finding that surprised me the most was that our sponsored research portfolio in water is about the same size as the sponsored research portfolio in automotive that the sector report we did a couple of years ago. And so it means that Michigan, by talent, by innovation opportunities, because we're also producing a large number of students in the broad array of these areas. It didn't include fishing and tourism. It was all sort of work-related. That it's not simply being surrounded by water and isn't it a great place for tourists to come. It really can be an enormous asset moving forward, particularly if we worry about protecting and preserving it, not just simply for today, but for tomorrow.
I'm talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon on MSU Today. I'm Russ White. President Simon, we're living in changing times in intercollegiate athletics. We talk about this a lot, and you have a front row seat as chair of the NCAA Executive Committee. What are some of the key issues this summer you're grappling with?
Well, obviously, we have to move through the reform of Division I. I was startled when the Division I board approved cost of attendance, which is one of the issues that's surfacing in the press now, that it was overridden by the membership. And that sort of slowed a reform agenda. And I think we have to remember that the NCAA is a membership organization, and it's not a president in Mark Everett or even a board of directors that can decide what will happen. Ultimately, the membership has to agree or overturn or, in a sense, disagree. And so but moving forward with this reform for Division I is really critical. Division I has grown over time from a relatively small number of members to 370 plus. And the issues are just very different across that spectrum. They're all sort of united by a common basketball tournament. In addition to that, I think that the press, everyone, keeps focusing on the 1%. There have always been students who come to Michigan State who are not athletes, who don't always take full advantage of their academic opportunities. It just doesn't define the students at Michigan State University. Over the years, if you think of our very large number, I guess Mark would say probably 800-plus student-athletes, that doesn't define their experience. That doesn't mean that their experience should be defined by the small handful who don't. And if you think about the NCAA collectively having 450,000 student-athletes, that's really the responsibility of the NCAA, not to solve an issue of a relatively small number of individuals, though that's what gets written about. So I think that the purpose of the NCAA is something kind of just lost. And if you think about being responsible for any large number of people as a principal, as a school district, as a collective family, as a university, you can't simply act on the needs of a small number. You have to act on the collective good for the individuals who are in your responsibility set and in the collective good in the long term for society. And we, after all, are educational institutions. And the dialogue around this is hard to manage in that context. In addition, like any large organization that has a rule book that is so complex and no way to get out of rules, whether you might be the U.S. Congress, a state legislature with regulatory issues, or NCAA, it is overly bureaucratic. It is hard to change. And we're in a time when change needs to be much faster. There's no question about it. But we sometimes lack the buttons and the ways of moving that change forward because you still have to have the membership approve it. So we have these lawsuits on the external part, on the cost of attendance question. There are things that they're proposing that we approve. They just didn't happen. On the question of student-athlete wellness, we're learning more and more each day. And the Big Ten was a pioneer in partnering with the Ivy League before this issue was on the front page to worry about concussion research. Our own faculty in kinesiology, sports medicine, youth sport have been studying these issues for a long time and trying to advise folks about ways to do what are occasionally collision sports more safely. And I'm proud that the NCAA has its first medical director to try to coordinate and translate science better into rules. But, you know, I can argue that it should have happened earlier. It's all true. But we also are learning more today than we ever knew about the brain and the long-term effects of the brain. And so, you know, we just got to get better. And this finger-pointing that's occurring as if there is another perfect solution, I find a little bit like the going from the BCS to the College Bowl Series. There'll be as much controversy in my mind about who's number five in this new order as there was before about who might be one or two. Or who should have been nine and not seven or whatever the numbers are, because we all have views about something that is relatively subjective unless there happens to be four perfect teams. And then it's pretty easy. But if there's not, then, or there may be even four perfect teams, and we're going to argue about whether their schedules were really strong enough, and maybe somebody who played one of those four perfect teams and lost by a single point in the last second shouldn't have been fourth. I mean, it's just the nature of all this chatter publicly about sport. It's sort of blown its value in our society out of proportion, in my view. I would also say that the greatest value to student-athletes is their degree in the long run, and that's also getting lost in the shuffle here.
Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon chairs the NCAA Executive Committee and leading the reform of Division I. President Simon, there's a new documentary out. It's titled Ivory Tower. I'm not sure if you've heard of it or not, but it another one of these asking the questions, is college still worth it? And obviously the data shows pretty dramatically that it is. But what's your thought on that topic, and are you growing even weary of hearing about it?
Well, I keep wondering what the alternative is. I think if all of us could have a really smart idea, I mean, like the person who made the spaghetti thing that, you know, they put in your cot and makes a lot of money out of it, that's terrific, and you probably didn't need a college degree for that. There are lots of other inventions in the world that are just sort of straightforward, people are creative, that you can create wealth. But if you think about today's jobs and tomorrow's jobs and the concerns about middle class and this have not, the data would be pretty clear that education makes an enormous difference in that equation. Now, is it as much as in the past? I mean, this entire sort of recession, global recession, has depressed salaries as companies and others are looking at productivity gains. But there's also the jobs that are being created are jobs that require these things. And so the job in which you can get paid, you know, $50,000 you know, is not, they're not that many there. I mean, even being a long-haul trucker requires some education. The technology around being working on electrical lines is much more complex. So does it require a PhD? No. Does it necessarily require a degree from Michigan State? No. Does it require post-secondary education? Yes. And so this debate also gets all sort of mucked up, because when people say it isn't required, they sometimes think it isn't, a degree from Michigan State isn't required. And that's also true, but it's always been true. So now there's just more and more of those jobs, though, that require something beyond high school. Now, should we be encouraging students in their senior year of high school who want to have a different career than what they imagine coming to Michigan State, taking community college courses? Yes. And trying to get that expertise as part of their skill set. Should be encouraging people who love working with their hands and don't see themselves sitting there reading in the way that they do, going to Pipe Fitter U? Yes. Will they learn at Pipe Fitter U that they need to know more mathematics? Yes. Will they need to know at Pipe Fitter U they need to know more technology? Yes. Will they learn at Pipe Fitter U that they need to be able to read more complex documents? Yes. But if that's the way they learn it, terrific, you know, because those jobs are really needed. The work of an auto mechanic is very different today. Does it require training? Yes. If that's your passion, go do it. But do it well. Do it well. And don't lament the fact that that in the old days you didn't need it. In the same way, I can say that if you look at all the data, that coming to a Michigan State type of place and completing is worth a lot. And that's what the data say.
Hear, hear. Well, President Simon, when we meet again in August, we'll be gearing up for fall semester, obviously. But what are a couple of other things Spartans should know that you're working on or thinking about this summer?
Well, we continue to try to think about what's going to be the new normal for higher education. Even with the 5.9% budget, you know, and tuition, you know, at near inflation recommendation of 2.5 or so for resident undergraduates, that still gives us only an inflationary budget, which means we have to continue to reduce and find new revenue sources besides tuition for academic competitiveness in the form of knowing that the market is heating up for the recruitment of faculty because talent is talent and talent is in demand. We also know that we have a very aging infrastructure, and the state isn't providing, as some of these states are, on top of these larger increases, money for deferred maintenance. We're an old campus. We have to figure out a way to make the reductions necessary to pay for those things, because we can't let this place crumble. It's going to be here. It's an investment. It has to return on the investment that people made it. We have, you know, an antiquated student information system, so we're thinking about how we're going to be able to do that. And then in addition to that, there's a lot of imagineering that happens over the summer about sort of what this place should be like 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, and beginning to plant those seeds now in the same way that the first light of a cyclotron was really planted 50 years ago. And those little seedlings of ideas have to be nurtured. So is that the new product ingredient center because the safety and quality of the ingredients make a huge difference in a global supply chain about the products that you're eating every day? Big risk, big opportunities. How do we, you know, have quality, cost, security in that issue? How do we think about the question of where are the next pieces for high-performance computing, computational biology, things that don't exist now but are around big data, big analytics, believing that liberal arts people with their designs and everything need to be engaged in that. So how do we think about all those things that are the seeds that you have to plant today nurture and grow. Some of them, all those ideas will never grow. But it's like your, it's like any kind of investment. You probably have to have more of those things because you don't have a perfect view of the future. And so we'll spend a lot of time in that imagineering.
President Simon, thanks again for sharing your current thoughts and insights with us on MSU Today.
Thanks very much, Russ. It's always a pleasure to work with you, and thank you for the way in which you represent Michigan State University so well, you and your colleagues.
Thank you so much. That's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon, and you can keep up with her at president.msu.edu. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, from the tragic story of America's passenger pigeon to Earth stories on quilts to the always wonderful Great Lakes Folk Festival, it's another very eventful summer for the Michigan State University Museum. And here to give us the scoop is good friend Laura Helou, who's the interim director of the MSU Museum. Laura, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Let's start with the passenger pigeon and that sad, sad story of the extinction of a species.
That's right. Mm. Yeah, this is just a really profound and compelling story, I think. And we, along with several museums around the country, are taking this time to tell this story because it's actually the 100th year that the last passenger pigeon died. So 2014 is 100 years past Martha, who was one of two surviving passenger pigeons, George and Martha. Martha died at the Cincinnati Zoo in 1914. And her remains were then preserved at the Smithsonian. But this is a way for us to kind of call attention to this tragic, tragic story and really kind of use it as a way to help people think about human impact in the environment, our relationship with the animal world, conservation, stewardship of resources. But it's a really, really compelling story. So I hope you get a chance to check the exhibit out.
Oh, definitely. Laura, there were accounts at the time of it. This was one of the largest species of bird ever recorded. I mean, there are accounts that are just incredible.
That's right. It's just staggering when you think about it. There are estimates that there were between 3 and 5 billion of these birds. One in every four birds in North America was a passenger pigeon. Mostly their habitat ranged around the eastern part of the United States from the Rockies on over. And they were a nomadic bird, an asocial bird. So they just traveled in these huge, enormous flocks. And the descriptions of them give me chills. You know, when you read about it, it talks about the sound they made. It sounded like a thunderstorm or sleigh bells or, you know, hurricane winds that these smallish birds, but when together in these flocks, just completely transformed the environment, really. The weight of them sometimes would break tree limbs.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
Well, part of the exhibit, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of your colleagues who has helped to put the exhibit together has tried to recreate that incredible sound that you're talking about.
That's right. Yeah, Pam Rasmussen is the curator of this exhibit. She's an ornithologist, so she works at our museum as well as the Department of Zoology at MSU. And she had started a database of bird sounds, so she's been collecting those from all around the world. And so based on some accounts and descriptions and some similar species, she's tried to create this soundscape and kind of multiply and layer it and kind of give you that sense of what it's like to be surrounded by these birds that would literally darken the sky.
I can only imagine what it must be for adults to hear that sound, but what about the kids that come through museums? It's got to be incredible.
It's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. We try with our exhibits, and this one especially, to create sort of an immersive
Absolutely.
Environment. So you're stepping into an environment that takes you someplace else and sort of prompts you to think about another place, another time, and some issues that we're confronting.
Well, speaking about one species is extinct and there's another species that's in a bit of trouble, you have an exhibit related to turtles.
That's right. Mm. That's right. This spring we opened an exhibit in our Art Science Creativity Gallery. Real fun exhibit, I think. People of all ages will enjoy this one too. It's called Turtles in Trouble. And turtles, you know, they're tough and they're survivors. They've been around for millions and millions of years. They were around with the dinosaurs. They made it through the ice ages. So turtles are tough, but, you know, life is not easy for them. They're facing some challenges. It's estimated that almost two-thirds of turtle species are threatened or declined. So we wanted to produce this exhibit, and it's kind of a good companion to the passenger pigeon story.
Absolutely.
Because these are animals we live with now, and so there's a chance to, you know, to kind of raise the awareness and think about stewardship and conservation there too. So in this exhibit, we have some examples of species that you would find in Michigan, as well as some from around the world that are threatened, endangered, and facing extinction. And there are some species in Asia that are only bred in captivity, so they're virtually extinct in the wild, and you'll only encounter them maybe in a market setting.
My guest is Laura Halu, and she is the interim director of the MSU Museum. Let's move from actual species, the mm-hmm. turtles and the pigeons, mm-hmm. to depictions of the environment on quilts.
Sure. We have an exhibit that opened at the museum this spring called Earth Stories. And this is a collaboration with a group called the Studio Art Quilt Associates. These are people who make art quilts, or kind of contemporary, artistic, sometimes avant-garde quilts. So these aren't the sort of historic geometric patterns that you might have seen in some of your heritage quilts. But these
or
are
some of your other many quilts.
That's right, in our collection.
Over the years,
yeah. So these are contemporary, and these are sort of what we would call story quilts, or quilts with a message. So these were created by people who wanted to convey a point of view or express their beliefs about a certain cause. And in this case, it's an environmental cause. So that's another, you know, really good companion to have at our museum at this time of year. It's a real good compliment to the passenger pigeon and the turtle story too. So we have people from all around the world. There are close to 30 textiles in this exhibit, and they were tasked with, tell us a story. What does this issue or this place mean to you? So we have one that came to us from Monroe, Michigan, where the quilter looks at restoration and reclamation of the Raisin River there.
Yeah.
So she has, you know, sort of a before and after, and she's depicted in this quilt. It's just fantastic, sort of a stagnant river gone wrong, and then she has another side of it that shows life coming back and the rich aquatic life that's in the River Raisin. We have one that came to us from Sweden that looks at energy-saving light bulbs. Hmm. And she's actually integrated illuminated light bulbs into this quilt. So I think that's the first time we've had an illuminated quilt in our
museum. Well, you've got one
that's
on your website that depicts
right.
wind turbines.
That's right.
Which
that's
is a
right.
pretty impressive quilt.
Yeah, yeah. So alternative energy and fossil fuels. She's got this kind of debate going in the quilt to sort of challenge us to think about the energy that we use and the way that we get energy to fuel our needs. And coincidentally, this was without even planning, one of the quilts is about a turtle preserve.
Ah, so just happened serendipitously.
Yeah, it reinforces kind of the Turtles in Trouble exhibit. So it gets us to think about habitats and habitat restoration.
You know, Laura, this it reminds me of something we try and emphasize mm-hmm. on this show, the interface between arts and culture, socio-sustainability and environmental sustainability. The quilt exhibit is a paradigm example of that.
It's fantastic. I think more than any other textile exhibit that we've had in the past that I can think of, this is one that really prompts people to think about these issues. And these quilts really are talking to us.
Yes.
So you really get that sense when you walk into the gallery that there's a conversation going on, that, you know, you can see immediately the issues and the ideas that these quilters are taking on. And it begs you to interact. You know, it begs you for a reaction and to think. And that's just exactly what we want to do with these kind of exhibits, is to really prompt a conversation and to give people something to walk away with.
Well, let's step out of the warm confines of the museum for a moment. I know it's August and it's a little ways off here, but something that you folks do just about, well, you do it every year, and that's the Great Lakes Folk Festival.
That's right.
Give us a snapshot of that. We may do something else a little bit ahead of that, but what's going on this year?
Fantastic. Yeah, so it's a year-round production planning for the festival.
Sure it is.
and it's coming up quick. It's coming up August 8th through the 10th in downtown East Lansing. And so we'll produce a three-day celebration of culture, tradition, community. Music is always one of the real highlights of this event, so we really try and showcase diverse and eclectic musical styles and traditions. And once again, we'll have a really diverse lineup, everything from some fiddling traditions. We'll have blues. We'll have some bluegrass. We've got Cajun music. So it's going to be high energy, and we've incorporated a lot of dance this year too. So we've got opportunities for people to participate in contra dance, buck dancing. We'll have some Lindy Hop and swing dance music. So you'll have a chance to get out there and kind of cut a rug too.
Well, I've attended it many times over the years, and I know my great producer, Russ Whitehead, as well. We are both looking forward to it. For more information on these wonderful exhibits and the Great Lakes Festival and all of that, Laura, the website is?
The website is museum.msu.edu.
That's pretty easy to remember.
That's right.
Well, Laura, you're very, very busy over there, as always. It's always great to find out what's going on. I encourage listeners to get to the MSU Museum as many times as they can. And thank you for being a guest on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thanks, Kirk.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment. Kirk Heinze with more Greening of the Great Lakes.
Well, the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development has recently announced the 2014 Agricultural Exporter of the Year, and this year it's the companies whose export sales have grown dramatically over the past 2 years, especially to North Africa and Asia. Here to tell us about the award is Jamie Smitgo-Summers. She's the International Marketing Program Manager for the Michigan Department of Ag and Rural Development and a frequent guest on this program, along with Steve Cooper, COO and General Manager of this year's winner, Continental Dairy Facilities, based in Coopersville. Jamie, it's always good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much, Kirk.
And Steve, congratulations and welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Jamie, let's start with you. I know you've talked about this on the program before, but give our listeners a little bit of a snapshot about the International Marketing Program and this award, the Ag Exporter of the Year.
Well, our exports from Michigan keep increasing every year, and this award is a way that we can really showcase the great companies here in Michigan that are exporting products that are grown and produced and processed here in Michigan. So we feel it's a great way to not only highlight those individual companies, but to highlight all of the great products and the great work that our Michigan companies and farmers and growers are doing here to export products.
Jamie, in previous interviews, I mean, you've surprised me and I think some of our listeners to the extent that we export Michigan agricultural products. So I would imagine the competition for this award is pretty stiff.
It is very stiff. We had some great companies this year. I know our committee diligently worked to determine who the most appropriate company is for this year, and we think we have a great company, a great representative in Continental Dairy Facilities as the 2014 Michigan Ag Exporter of the Year.
Now, before we meet Steve here and talk a little bit more about his enterprise, remind our listeners about how much of Michigan-produced agricultural product is exported.
In 2012, the U.S. Department of Agriculture reported that Michigan exported over $3.2 billion, and that has been a steady increase year over year. We've seen continued growth, and we're expecting that 2013 and 2014, we will again have increases. And with that, it's supporting over 20,000 jobs based on the exports that we have coming out of Michigan, and certainly a lot of economic impact that goes back to the growers and producers here in Michigan that are benefiting from the exports that these companies are doing.
You work with these folks all the time, and you're working with the export markets as well. What do you attribute this recent growth to? Probably a number of factors.
Certainly. I think a lot of people know that the world population is growing. And certainly as the world population grows and the middle class grows, they want to have products that they know are safe. We see that a lot, especially with China. They want to have a safe product, and they know that the U.S. has very high quality standards. So certainly the growth in the middle class around the world has brought a lot of opportunity to our Michigan companies.
What do you find working with folks that the biggest difficulties or barriers are to opening export markets?
I think for a lot of companies, it's kind of the fear of the unknown. And so we really work with companies to provide assistance and to connect them with service providers. We often tell companies you don't have to be an expert at exporting. It's making sure you're working with the right partners. And I think with Continental Dairy Facilities, they are certainly doing that. They're not necessarily doing everything themselves, but are working with very competent partners that can help make their exports a success and go throughout the world.
Well, this reluctance that you mentioned, I mean, I imagine it can be intimidating, because if you're dealing with another country, you have all sorts of regulations and policies and trade agreements to deal with. But you're one of the things among many that your office does, you help people get over that, let's call it range anxiety, I guess, in terms of actually launching into the export markets.
Yeah, we certainly do. We offer a number of different educational programs throughout the year, export seminars that companies can attend either in person, or if they can don't have the time, they can also do them online in the form of a webinar. So lots of different ways we try to get information out to companies and provide education and assistance to those companies to help them kind of overcome those barriers and hurdles and help them better understand what it takes to export, whether they're doing it all of themselves or if help in finding the right partners.
Well, here, before we meet Steve again, let's come back to the Ag Exporter of the Year. Exactly how is the winner essentially determined?
Well, the companies submit an application, and we have a very competent panel of judges that review all of those applications. So we actually pull professionals from the industry, so those that work in international finance, those from different organizations that work on exporting and assisting companies. That panel actually reviews and scores those applications and then makes a recommendation to the director of the Michigan Department of Ag and Rural Development for the final selection and approval of the winner. And this year certainly was some stiff competition.
I've been talking with Jamie Smitko-Summer. She's the International Marketing Program Manager for the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. Well, next up is Steve Cooper. Steve is the COO and General Manager of Continental Dairy Facilities, located in Coopersville, Michigan. Continental Dairy Facilities is the 2014 recipient of the Agricultural Exporter of the Year that's bestowed by the Michigan Department of Ag and Rural Development. Steve, first of all, congratulations on the award.
Thank you very much.
Tell our listeners a little bit about Continental Dairy Facilities and this amazing success you've had in the export market.
Well, we're a relatively new company to Michigan. We've been operational now for 2 years. Our first year really was concentrating on really getting a brand new plant up and running and doing more domestic, focusing more on domestic sales. And this last year, we partnered with a marketer. We don't do all of our own marketing. And our marketer saw an opportunity with exports this year, with New Zealand having a drought and the EU getting a slow start to their milk production season to go into exports. And we jumped into exports, and about 70% of all of our non-fat dry milk that we produce went into exports this year.
Now, for listeners who may not be familiar with non-fat dried milk, give us a snapshot of what that is.
It's really, we take the skim milk portion of the whole milk after we've separated the cream off of it. We condense it, and then we dry it into a powder form where it's about 4% moisture. It increases the shelf life of the product to 18 to 24 months, and it's a base food ingredient.
And then when this product arrives overseas, and I assume that they reintroduce some moisture.
Yeah, they rehydrate it. It goes into a number of different dairy products. It goes back into fluid milk, ice cream. It can go into baking, cheese making, just a number of different uses.
Now, the growth that you guys have achieved, some of it's been in North Africa and some of it's been in Asia. One might not think, people might think Mexico or Canada or something more close by. How did it all happen?
Well, you know, our first year we really concentrated on Mexico. We grew that business. This last year we've put about 20% of all of our product into Mexico. We saw some opportunity to go into North Africa. 40% of all of our sales were into North Africa, into Algeria this year. We did 5 Algerian tenders. And then we started getting into Southeast Asia, into China and Vietnam this year. And this next year, we're really focusing on the Southeast Asian market. One of the ways we can compete with the big co-ops on the West Coast that produce the milk powder out there, most of the milk powder in the United States, is because our road laws here in Michigan, we can put more powder on a container, and it really equalizes the freight cost to the West Coast to get it to Southeast Asia.
So you're trucking this powder down to the Detroit area typically, and then it goes out by rail to the West Coast where it's shipped over. Is that the supply chain?
Yes, it is. We take it straight into the Detroit rail yards, and it goes on a flat car, goes into either Long Beach or Oakland, and then it goes right on the ship.
Has this milk product demand from places like Algeria and Southeast Asia been a growing phenomenon, or have they always been interested in dried milk?
Most of the markets worldwide have been interested in dried milk. China is a big growing customer. You know, they've been growing at a phenomenal clip over the last few years, and that market is getting, you know, bigger for all of us. And, you know, they demand, like Jamie said, they demand a very high quality product. And we've gone in there with a very good quality product. We're now known as the Gold Star brand in Southeast Asia. That was really a comment that they came up with, our exporters came up with, because our logo is a gold star. And really, the Gold Star brand is synonymous with high quality powder.
Steve, I don't need to tell you this, but those markets in Asia, I mean, they're tough to crack into. I think of Japan, for example, but China as well. If you don't have top star quality like you guys have, I mean, you might be in there for a while, but then it's all over with.
That's true. And the key is with our co-op, we start with an excellent quality product. Our producers produce some of the best quality milk in the United States. We start with that. It's much easier for us to produce a very high quality product. We usually go in with a better quality product than most people see, and then, you know, the sales will you know, grow from there.
Now, your producers in the co-op, I assume most of them are in West Michigan. I mean, you're from the Coopersville area, but are these people up in Kent County and Ottawa County, or are they from a much broader range than that?
Well, our co-op is primarily based in Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio. Most of our milk, though, is all coming from the Michigan area. We're balancing for our co-op, but we're also balancing for 3 other co-ops as well. So we're kind of a regional balancing plant for the different milk-producing co-ops in that area.
My guest is Steve Cooper. He's the COO and General Manager of Continental Dairy Facilities, just won the 2014 Agricultural Exporter of the Year Award. What are the biggest challenges, Steve, when it comes to exporting product from Michigan to places like Southeast Asia or North Africa?
Really, our biggest challenge, it hasn't been so much a challenge with us, but there are some challenges. You know, our key management staff has had a lot of experience with exports with our former careers. When we came here, we brought that with us. We partnered with a company that just does a great job with exporting and is in that market every day with other ag products, and really partnering with the right exporters. And we partnered with some former New Zealand people that have their own exporting company that have that expertise. Partnering with those people make it a lot easier, but really understanding the product specifications up front with the customers, and that's essential because their specifications for export are so much more difficult than domestic powder, and meeting those expectations of those customers and really understanding all of the logistics and everything that's, you know, documentation and things that are, associated with the exports.
You know, coming back to an initiative of Governor Snyder since he's been governor, and the Michigan Department of Ag and Rural Development, but when you expand export markets, typically you're expanding jobs as well. Has that been the case for you folks?
Yes, it has. You know, we took over an old auto parts plant that was empty, had been empty for 4 years. We bought that property about 5 years ago, started developing our company. We built a company from the ground up, designed and built the plant, and started employing people. We now employ 80 people. We now have expanded our site. Our site is now known as a dairy park. We have another dairy company a sister company on the property, which is growing that, and they're adding jobs. They've added 85 jobs, and they're soon to add another 133 jobs.
So it's good for Michigan agriculture. It's good for the Michigan economy. It's good for those folks around the world that are getting your product. 700% increase, I think. I saw the number from 2012-13. That's amazing.
It is. You know, like I said, that first year we were really concentrating on domestic sales. Last year, we marketed over 90 million pounds of powder, and over 64 million pounds of that powder went to exports.
I don't want to get into any proprietary information, but given the success of the last couple of years, Steve, are you looking at some other markets around the world? I imagine you're going to continue to want to grow this.
Yes, we are. Actually, we are expanding. We're now going to about 14 different countries.
Can you tip us off on what some of those countries might be, or is that still proprietary?
No, it's not. Our 14th customer became Morocco. We are now the sole dairy supplier for Danone Morocco. We are going into Thailand, Malaysia. We've gone into Australia. We've gone into Saudi Arabia, Egypt. And we are going to China, Vietnam, and Canada. So we've kind of hit quite a broad variety of countries.
I've got to ask you this question, but, you know, we've talked heard a lot about the growth of India and China, the Arab Spring, and you're into all of these different markets. Is this all sort of a function of better lifestyles over there, healthier diets, the demand for milk is associated with all those sorts of things?
I believe so. Especially when you look at the Middle East and you look at China, it's, you know, China wants a high-quality product. It is because of their lifestyle and the fact that it is a healthier diet, and they're looking for these dairy ingredients. And like Jamie says, they trust in the U.S. products. And the high level of trust they have in the quality of the U.S. products is really what's been driving this export business.
What do you suppose the reaction will be among some of your producers out there when they find out that they're part of this 2014 Ag Exporter of the Year Award?
They're ecstatic about it. This is really something that came as a surprise to us. We didn't exactly think we were going to grow this business as fast as we would. We've grown it at a phenomenal pace, and they are just absolutely pleased with the overall success.
Well, it's an amazing success story. Again, congratulations to you, Steve Cooper, COO and General Manager of Continental Dairy Facilities, 2014 recipient of the Michigan Ag Exporter of the Year Award. Continued success going forward, and thanks so much for being a guest on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
And here's MSU Journalism Senior Gabby Saldivia.
Off the beaten path, a few miles south of campus, sits the Michigan State University Student Organic Farm. Past the rows of greenhouses, a dirt road leads to 15 acres of sprawling organic farmland. It was an exceptionally cold and wet day for May. The perfect condition for pigs.
The project began really small.
That's Lori Thorpe, director of the Residential Initiative on the Study of the Environment and the co-founder of the Student Organic Farm and Pasteurized Pig Project.
We brought out four pretty well-developed animals the first year, and that first year was just to begin to look at what does small-scale outdoor pig management and integration into a crop system look like.
According to Lori,
pigs made perfect sense because of some of their qualities.
The two mama pigs and 17 piglets do a lot for the farm. They weed the land because of their natural rooting tendencies and produce manure, which contributes to the overall fertility of the soil.
We're layering ecosystems. Is that what we're doing here is artfully working with nature and working with ecology to farm, which takes great knowledge of multiple species across plants and animals, and how do we weave them together to create this sustainable farm system.
Here, what are you doing? Oh, there. Yes, belly rub. Yeah, so it looks like you got a little scratch there. What'd you do?
Lexi Hinson is an MSU student who works at the farm.
A day like today where, you know, it's what, maybe 55 and cold and raining. We still love it, but it's not always easy. So this is a perfect example of that. And many people, you know, have the misconception that it is, you know, always sunny and always beautiful, but it's not, and we have to deal with it when it's not, too. We don't just get to come out here when it's nice.
Lexi is passionate and devoted to working on the project. Not only does she go to the farm every day, she also studies the piglets. Her focus is on the cross-nursing between the two litters, And you could say she knows them pretty well.
This is Chocolate, actually, right here. And Squirt, and I think Domino is on my back right now. And Patches, and Lucky took 4 hours of labor to get out.
A unique set of skills are gained by the students when working with the animals in a complex living dynamic system, like the Student Organic Farm. Lori says these abilities are formed almost exclusively outside of the classroom.
Some of these really important character traits that they develop are what Lexi was starting to talk to you about, is persistence and patience and ability to work across boundaries and ability to work in complex, complicated, difficult conditions. And you don't develop those skills in a classroom with a textbook. You develop those working on real, live, complex problems like sustainable farming.
And the learning process continues. As students and staff face the reality that these pigs are raised for human consumption and will go to slaughter in October.
Explaining to students that aspect of it is sometimes hard, especially I've had little kids come out here and they ask too, and I tell them flat out, I'm like, this is pork production. These are pork production animals. And that's probably the hardest part for people to grasp.
Lori says this piece of the project is probably the most difficult part, but in that same vein, the most important. In an effort to be ethical eaters and responsible producers, students requested to accompany the animals to slaughter and to be present on the kill floor for the processing.
That's a very, very difficult day, a very, very difficult time, but I think it's also a really important piece that if we're really sincere about becoming ethical eaters and wanting to know about all the pieces of the food system along the supply chain, it's not enough to just embark in the fun piece, the farrowing and the darling piglets, but it's also to say, I want to know what does it mean to slaughter an animal.
Working with the pigs presents lots of valuable lessons. But above all, it instills a unique ethic of care.
When you learn to care for another being or another species, you then develop those skills to care for an ecosystem or for a farm or a farm community. And then that radiates out even further, and you learn to develop an ethic of care for the even larger systems that are at stake right now.
And that's what the Pig Project is all about. Going forward, the lessons learned, skills acquired, and real-world experience give students and community members a chance to see a real food system in action, make their own decisions regarding ethical eating, and take some knowledge with them about how to be better stewards of the world around them. I'm Gabriela Saldivia for MSU Today.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. You know, we live in a time where people just don't join things anymore. So why are so many Spartans joining the MSU Alumni Association? Well, perhaps it's our world-class alumni enrichment team, constantly stretching Spartan minds and supercharging Spartan careers. Or perhaps it's our Spartan pipeline, which connects you to trusted friends wherever your adventures may take you. The MSU Alumni Association is dedicated to adding Spartan value to your Spartan life. Whatever it is that may be keeping you up at night, we can connect you with a fellow Spartan who can help. We truly live in a world where who you know is just as important as what you know. And joining the MSU Alumni Association can help you build the relationships you need for success on the job and in every corner of your Spartan life. That's why more and more Spartans are joining the MSU Alumni Association. Activate your membership right now at alumni.msu.edu.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, please click on the local tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.